17 past the hour on the Janet Mefford Show. Well, for a number of months now, we have been covering the Sovereign Grace Ministries lawsuit tied to what I have been calling American evangelicalism's biggest sex scandal to date. And in this suit, 11 plaintiffs now are alleging that leaders and workers connected with Sovereign Grace Ministries committed repeated acts of sexual and physical abuse on young children and then conspired to cover up the crimes. Now, a second amended version of this original lawsuit has been filed. It's added on more plaintiffs, and some of these plaintiffs have even now revealed their names. And joining us now to tell us the latest is Attorney Bill O'Neill, co-counsel for the plaintiffs in the Sovereign Grace Ministries lawsuit and attorney at the O'Neill Group. And it's just great to have you back. Bill, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I sat down and I read this entire thing last night because I wanted to bring myself up to speed. And I've never read anything more brutal. I've never read anything sadder, more I'm speechless. I'm so upset at these allegations, and I'm sure that you have had a similar reaction. But now you've got 11 plaintiffs, and that's a significant number of people to come forward and to share similar types of stories.
Yes, that's right. And we've been contacted by more, some who have just been unable to go forward. You know, it's as painful as it is to read, it was even more difficult to write. And to sit with these people and hear their stories is it's difficult to deal with.
Well, I can imagine. But you're talking about people who were abused years ago when they were very small children. We're talking in some cases 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds.
Yes, that's correct.
I mean, this is and girls, and you have 5 now who have come out and given their names. So what was behind the decision of these plaintiffs to actually name their real names rather than hiding behind pseudonyms?
Well, I think in part that your question reveals why they did it. You know, they were being accused by the church and by others of hiding their identities and that they weren't willing to go on the record. And I think all the way down the line, all 11 plaintiffs who've joined the suit to date, their number one goal is to expose what's been happening at the church and to let other people know that they're not alone and that we think there were many more victims of what was going on. And each one of them decided individually to put their name out there so that people knew, you know, who they were, when it was happening, and that they might find the courage to come forward.
Right. Now, you have a lot of details in here. Obviously, we can't go through them all. But, for example, you talk about one pedophile who was convicted and jailed and then came back to the church. I mean, to what extent did this sort of stuff happen where somebody who was a known abuser of children, as you're alleging in this lawsuit, was allowed to be present among children and was not revealed to be a pedophile to people who didn't know any better?
And that's the real breach of trust that I think is at the heart of why these people came forward. They, you know, someone who had already been convicted of molestation-related charges would be having sleepovers at his house with children where parents didn't know the details of what had happened.
Wow. Why in the world?
The church officials definitely knew.
Yeah.
And participated in defending him in the courts.
Now, just out of curiosity, when the sleepovers would occur, were they in conjunction with the children of the couple, or was it just leader of the church is going to have a sleepover and a bunch of young kids come to my house?
It was not always in conjunction with the couple's children. There were sleepovers at one pedophile's house who he didn't have any children.
Okay,
he
that's
was
just
involved
weird.
In the youth ministry.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's just strange. Why? I mean, that should send up some red flags right there. I mean, that's just
it, I don't believe. Yeah, I don't believe it was unusual within
really?
Within this organization. It's it's in many ways the church is isolating. It doesn't encourage contact. It doesn't encourage participation in public schools or other community events outside the church. And so for many members of the church for many years, all of their social activities were built around the church.
Wow. And so that makes it easier to sort of not know what's going on because you're
right.
In this, yeah, trusting your own church and your
and
own school.
When the parents complained, the parents of the children who, you know, the parents knew their child had been molested, they would complain that they should be telling other parents they would be accused of gossiping. And they were told to keep the stories to themselves.
Good grief. Now, how often?
Great detail.
Yeah. Now, how often was that occurring? How often was it that the defendants, and there are 14 defendants named in this lawsuit, how often are you alleging that this was the case, that when parents would come or a child would come to somebody in the church leadership and say, I was abused or my child was abused, that they tended to do this sort of thing, as you're alleging in the suit, that they would just say, no, this is an internal matter. Don't go to the police. Don't talk to anybody else because it would be considered gossip.
Right. I think that was the normal response. To the extent, off the top of my head, I'm not aware of a situation where the plaintiffs that we're working with have went to a church official who said, one, we should call the police, and two, we should call social services. That was never a response.
Good grief. Well, you've got one of the people named in the lawsuit. One of the accused is John Loftness. He is the recently resigned chairman of the denomination. He has put out a statement saying he's never hurt a child, he's never abused a child. But what are the specific allegations against him, since he's one of the higher-ups?
Well, he was in addition to being as you say, a high up in the organization, he served for some years as the principal of the school, and there were extensive acts of pedophilia occurring at the school. And several of the plaintiffs recall his involvement directly in these acts.
Right.
And it's spelled out in detail. In painful detail.
In very painful detail. Right. And I emphasize, obviously, he's denying the charges and the courts are going to have to work through it. The recently resigned C.J. Mahaney, the founder of Sovereign Grace Ministries, is also named as one of the defendants. What is the allegation here of his role in what happened here at Sovereign Grace?
Well, from what we can tell, what everyone has told us is that C.J. Mahaney for many, many years was the authority within the church, and that there wasn't a church rule or doctrine or habit or custom that he did not approve of and participate in. So as the head of the church, it seems that it's impossible for someone to have that level of involvement and not know what was going on. Now, some of that is going to be subject to our ability to question him in discovery and to gain access to their files, which we have not had the opportunity to do yet.
Now, this has been going on, as I know, for a long time. I've heard references before to new policies being put in place, so things were handled well. What do we need to know about the policies that were later put into place once all these stories started to come out?
Well, I mean, one of the things about being an attorney involved in a lawsuit, I'm not reviewing each of their policies as they come out. You know, they have their public statements have stated that they're vehemently against child abuse and that they did not have a policy of not reporting. But in practice, what we've discovered in the past, and in part the lawsuit is primarily dealing with what was going on, what had happened in the past, they certainly did not report the incidents that were brought to their attention. So I can't really say that the new policies seem to be reiterations of what they said was their prior policy. So we'll have to see what in practice they do versus what they say on paper.
Right. Now, one of the things you mentioned, there's so much to talk about. I'm not going to get into the really gory aspects of this because I just can't handle it. But one of the things you mentioned in the suit here is that there were some defendants who began actively disseminating false and leading information to the police and to church members about an abuse situation involving a teenage boy, and then withheld certain facts, like the fact that this perpetrator had access to numerous toddlers in his role as a home group babysitter. So it seems that this is the thing that comes up again and again in your allegations, that people knew, but it was not talked about. It was not revealed to the extent that people needed to know. But this one just boggles the mind.
Right. On several different occasions, church officials kind of placed themselves between the accusers and the accused. And from the victim's point of view, it certainly appears that they were advocating very hard on behalf of the accused. Mm. And to a certain extent, there are allegations in the complaint, for example, that they would tell a family that a court date was the 25th, when in fact the court date was the 18th, so the family wouldn't be there. They misled families into missing their opportunity to present victim impact statements. They represented to the Virginia Commonwealth Attorney that they were that the pastors or church officials were talking on behalf of the family, when in fact that was not the case. So there's more than just one instance when families either had reported an incident before the church learned about it, or refused to abide by the church's instruction not to report and did report it, that didn't stop the defendants from actively interfering in the secular authorities' review of the cases.
Wow, I just can't get over the allegations here. How significant would you say this particular suit is when it comes to things that have happened in evangelical churches in America? Because, as I've said, this is the biggest sex abuse scandal I can recall in evangelicalism, at least in my lifetime. Do you have any thoughts on that at all?
I have to say I'm not familiar enough with the scope of the incidents across other evangelical churches, so I really can't comment on that. But I think most churches at this point have discovered at least some incidents within their ranks, and no church is immune from it.
Right. No, that's absolutely right. So what is next here? Here you've already done a Second Amendment amended lawsuit. Are you planning on amending it again to add more plaintiffs, or what happens from here?
Well, at a certain point, we will lose the opportunity to amend, people are still contacting us. We've alleged it as a class action, so we're seeking to go forward on behalf of all of the people who were injured. That needs to be approved by the court, and that hasn't occurred yet. The church has responded to the original lawsuit with a motion to dismiss, which is a legal challenge to the allegations in the complaint, and that hearing will be held soon, and may be ruled on probably towards the end of the summer.
Well, we will be keeping tabs on this important story. Bill O'Neill, the attorney for the plaintiffs in this Sovereign Grace lawsuit, just out with the second amended lawsuit. Bill, I really appreciate your time. Thank you for telling us the latest. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. We'll be back right after this.